report. Elizabeth is an infectious disease epidemiologist with the Bureau of Epidemiology and Public Health Informatics in the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, where she has worked since 2009. Her current position focuses primarily on perinatal hepatitis B prevention and childhood immunization assessments. She received her BS from the University of Toledo and her MS with a concentration in public health and microbiology from the George Washington University.
Thanks, Megan. Today I'm going to talk about the lessons that we learned in Kansas when we implemented a cocoon program to try and protect infants from pertussis at four project hospitals. Just a little bit of background, which most of you probably know. Pertussis is caused by Bordetella pertussis. It's frequently known as whooping cough. It's highly contagious, with most common symptoms being uncontrollable and violent coughing, and can also result in difficulty breathing and can be fatal, especially in infants under 6 months of age. The best way to prevent pertussis is through immunization, but as most of you know, the problem is that infants are not fully protected until they're 6 months. That is, if they're vaccinated at all. So a little bit of background. This is data reported to CDC between 1997 and 2000. The things to note are that infants under 6 months of age are one of the most highly diagnosed groups, but so are adolescents and adults, those between 10 years of age and above. However, if we look at hospitalizations that are due to pertussis, you can see that infants under 6 months are more frequently hospitalized due to this disease than other age groups, and that rate goes down as you age. If we look at complications such as pneumonia, again, infants are the most highly affected by these severe complications, and the same goes for seizures. And finally, mortality. You know, you're looking at 0.9% of infants who are diagnosed with pertussis pass away due to this disease, whereas it drops down to no more than about 0.1% for the older age groups. And this is a rise of pertussis that we've seen. This is a little bit older data, but from 1994 to 2004. And you can see that while pertussis in children under the age of four has increased, it's really those other age groups that I was pointing out before, those 10 to 19 years old, and then the adults. And what the biggest problem with this age group getting pertussis is that they have the ability to then pass it on to their infants. And this was shown through two studies. One was in 2004, and the other was in 2007. And these studies looked to see who was the source of infant pertussis. So if an infant got pertussis, who was coughing in the 2 weeks before the infant began coughing? And what they found that was 75% of the time when a source could be identified, it was from a close contact: mom, dad, grandparents, siblings. The others were typically aunts and uncles, cousins, or like daycare providers. So really, it's the people who are around the children all the time, who should be, you know, there to protect the child, who inadvertently are giving pertussis to these infants, who again can have very severe complications. So what can we do about it? In 2001, the Global Pertussis Initiative recommended cocooning, which is essentially the immunization of family members and close contacts of the newborn. In 2006, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices recommended the same thing. They mimic the recommendations of the GPI. And in this, two particular groups are targeted. The first are postpartum women before hospital discharge, and then contacts of infants under 1 year of age. So again, a lot of these are grandparents or siblings or daycare providers. So our immunization program manager and my co-author for this, who couldn't be here, were very passionate people about cocooning and infant pertussis and preventing it. And so they found some money. And the objectives of our pilot program were to increase pertussis awareness, particularly in healthcare providers as well as in families of newborns. The California outbreak has raised awareness, but I think a lot of people believe this is one of those diseases that is in the past. You know, we had it when we were kids, everything's fine, it's not around anymore, but we know that to be false. Another objective was to immunize 80% of postpartum women delivering at our project hospitals, and then we also wanted to immunize one designated family member, and this person was designated by the mother. It was most frequently going to be the father of the infant, but it could also be a grandparent or a daycare provider. So first we had to choose who we were going to invite into our program. We had limited money. We had enough for 1,600 doses of Tdap booster. And so we decided that if we had two people vaccinated for every infant, that was enough for 800 births. So we wanted to identify a few small hospitals that would add up to that 800. We also wanted them to be enrolled in vaccines for children. And this was done for several reasons. One was that we already had a contract with them. Additionally, we wanted them to have the capacity. We also wanted location, much like real estate, it's location, location, location. So we wanted it within a day's round-trip drive from where we're located in Topeka, and this was because we knew we'd have several visits to them in the growing stages of this project. We also wanted the hospital to be located next to our local health department, and this was going to be done because our local health department was going to be providing the immunization for that family member. And finally, they needed to be willing to participate. We were looking for people that we'd worked well with before and who had physicians and OBGYN nurses that were passionate about this and as passionate as we were. So as you can see, we have three counties highlighted. We had three counties and four hospitals. So obviously, two hospitals in one of our counties. So initially in 2010, January, we began making presentations to these four hospitals and their local health departments. We got them all in the same room. It was typically the charge nurse for the labor and delivery unit, maybe the pharmacist, maybe an infection practitioner, and the local health department. And our goals that we presented to them were that we wanted to have standing orders for postpartum Tdap, and then we wanted the Tdap to be administered either on hospital discharge or before, whichever worked best for them. And originally, our plan for the caregiver was a voucher. Now, this voucher we wanted to be given during pre-registration, which we learned not all hospitals have pre-registration, but they could also be given during the hospital stay. And this is what our voucher originally looked like. It was about the size of a coupon that you would cut out from the newspaper or a business card. And the reason for this was we thought that men could put it in their wallets, and it would be an easier way to keep track of it and not be lost. Everything else on there, the mom's initials, date, was just tracking methods. The relationship to the newborn, that was so that we could know who was being vaccinated, who we were protecting during this program. And then we also put on all of the information about that local health department that was going to be partnering with that hospital. The location, the phone number, as well as the hours in which the caregiver could go and actually be vaccinated. So what happened? So in the first 6 months, we got everybody on board. And in looking at it, we had 248 births during that project time. And of that, 208 moms got vaccinated, which was 84% almost. So we were thrilled with these numbers. We thought this was extremely successful. However, then we started looking at the primary caregivers. We vaccinated 17% at our hospitals and our local health departments. So we needed to change some things. Postpartum vaccination was on target. Again, we were thrilled with the success our hospitals were having. But the primary caregiver vaccination was far lower than we expected and far lower than it needed to be. So when we were giving feedback to our hospitals, one hospital took it upon themselves, they're having a slow period in the childbirthing time, and they called up all of the parents who had not vaccinated, who had not been vaccinated, the father, the caregiver, and asked, you know, how's your infant, and oh, by the way, did you go and get this? And when they talked about what the barriers were and why they didn't do it, these were three of the most common things they heard. One was the men were afraid of needles. Thank you, Mom, for having childbirth. You know, the second was time. You know, you get out of the hospital, you know, baby's home, dad goes back to work. They just don't have the time to go to the health department. And then the other one was a lost voucher. So apparently our brilliant idea to have it small enough to fit in the wallet was not so successful. We also looked at health departments. And so these are two of our three. And we wanted to look at some of the differences between them. So at one of our health departments, no appointment was necessary, but in the other, there was. The local health departments were encouraged not to charge an administration fee since they were getting this vaccine for free from us, or at no cost to them. And so one of our counties did, in fact, forego that administration fee, whereas the other said that they thought it was necessary. At the first county, they were using the Healthy Start nurses to go out and provide education when they were visiting the families and encouraging them to go get the vaccine. Whereas in the second county, they sent packets to new parents. That was their protocol. The proximity was exactly the same. They were both directly across the street from the hospital. But if you looked at the rates, it was almost half at the hospital or at the local health department that required both appointments and administration fees. So these are obviously additional barriers that were preventing caregivers from going and receiving this vaccine. So that hospital that I told you about that went ahead and called all the parents, we were heading back down there to try and figure out what we could do, how we could improve this project. And the charge nurse in the labor and delivery unit was on top of this. She was our go-getter of the group. And she had actually worked with her department, and they had developed standing orders for the family member to be vaccinated at the hospital before the mom and infant were discharged. This was incredible and something that we had tossed around when we were first starting this, but never really thought it would work because there's so many barriers. And what she had realized is that she really needed to involve all of the stakeholders that she could, which included medical records and pharmacists and the admissions and billing, because it was a multifaceted issue at these hospitals. So some of the stumbling blocks that we've seen as we've tried to implement this going forward in our other project hospitals were kind of the problem between admission and no admission. There's a concern when you don't admit somebody and you're giving them a vaccine in the hospital that there's a liability concern if something was to go wrong, even though they are signing the consent form. There's also a concern about tracking. Somebody comes back to the hospital, years later and says, I got something here and I don't know what it was, but they were never in the computer system. That's also causing a problem. Additionally, cost. If you admit somebody, there's admission costs and all those things, and there's billing. But there's also costs for the swabs and some of the supplies. So that's also been a problem that our hospitals have run across in trying to implement this. And finally, something else we discovered is hospital conglomerates. So one of our project sites was part of a conglomerate where the headquarters was in St. Louis, and they had the same standing orders for every single hospital, and it was on the computer. So in order to add a new standing order was exceptionally difficult. And so that hospital, in fact, decided that it was better not to do standing orders, but just have an individual order for each mom. However, in terms of vaccinating the caregiver, they have not been able to implement that. So it's been a very big challenge. So how did we do? So this is, that go-getter of a hospital that we love, our golden child. As you can see, in July, they began vaccinating. We jumped from 17% in June to 64% in July of caregiver vaccinations. So not as high as that 80%, but we never really expected it to get to that level. But the fact that we had a threefold increase in the course of a month in vaccinating, and as you can see in November, it was even higher. So we've definitely proven this can be successful. And our other hospitals that have implemented it, we've seen an increase. We just don't have as much data to show the longevity of it. So I'm going to do the one thing that I've always been told not to do and use cliches in my presentation. So these are our lessons learned. The first is the best laid plans. We came into this thinking we knew everything. We were going to do vouchers on, pre-admission. This is how it was going to work. We basically got schooled as we walked into these hospitals. It was very different. They needed to work through it on how they could do it. And we found out we knew very little. There's more than meets the eye. Again, we went in there thinking that it would be the labor and delivery, bring in the pharmacist. And as we went through it, and especially in implementing this caregiver vaccination, we found that you need so many more people in that hospital, the admissions, the billing, the medical records. There's more than one way to skin a cat. Our hospitals are all very different. They work very differently. For instance, in terms of vaccinating the caregiver, our go-getter hospital, they went ahead and just put the consent form in a folder. They call it the Adacel folder. And they put that in the OBGYN ward, and then every 6 months or so, they bring it downstairs and put it in medical records. That's how they choose to keep track of their vaccine for the caregiver. Another hospital at this time is putting it in mom's charts, but they are looking to do kind of a modified admission for their hospital because they felt that was the way that they needed to go. The other is get them while they're hot. We realized after those 6 months that you can't let those parents, the caregiver, get out of that hospital. We have this theory that when they're in the hospital, the infant looks very fragile and they feel the need to protect them. And when you get them home and they're back in the regular environment, things change. So you need to get them while they're at the hospital or else you get 17% vaccination rates. Don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. It would have been very easy to look at our 80% vaccination rates of moms and say, this is great. Our other program's not working. Let's ditch that. And let's focus. And we had to fight to keep this going. And it would have been so easy, but through the ingenuity of our partners and through a lot of hard work, we were able to figure out how to make this a successful program and get 64% of our family members vaccinated. And finally, it takes a village. It took our program manager to be passionate about this, to find the money. It took our local health departments. It took our hospital staff, it took our immunization staff to work out new ordering methods and tracking methods since we had only four sites. It really took everybody working together to get this to be a very successful program and to get it to work. So I want to acknowledge Martha Simpson, my teammate in this project, who spent a lot of time and a lot of work on it. Sue Bowden, our program immunization manager, and all the immunization staff. And then these are our project sites and hospitals.